For those of you staying, welcome to the final part of this evening, which is our panel discussion. My name is Mary Martin. I'm director of the UN Business and Human Security Initiative at LSE Ideas. We've just watched, I think, an extraordinary inside, sometimes intimate and very personal account of what happened in the run-up and the signing and the aftermath of the Colombian peace agreement, which, as we know, is the start, we hope, of an ongoing peace process. On the panel this evening, I've got three very distinguished representatives who can perhaps give us we're all outsiders, but a different perspective to the one we've just seen on screen. Mark Silva is the film's director. He is an award-winning filmmaker who has specialized in making documentaries that have a very strong social message. And they range from the topic we've seen tonight to immigration across the U.S.-Mexico border. And his first film, 3.5 Bullets, about a racial shooting in Florida. Anik Hinch is UN Political Affairs Director at what the UN loves in these acronyms in the system, UNLOPS, which is the Liaison Office for Peace and Security based in Brussels, so an important kind of interlocutor for the UN system and other international organizations, as well as bringing together so many different parts of the UN system and its different functions. And on her left is Lord John Alderdice, who has a distinguished career as a Northern Ireland peacemaker. And we're going to hear about some of his experiences this evening, going through the Northern Ireland peace process, but also as Speaker of the Northern Ireland Assembly and founder of the Northern Ireland Alliance Party. I'd like to begin. We have about 20 minutes or so. I'm just going to invite the panelists to give us some of their views, partly on what we've just seen, but partly on their perspectives, putting what we've seen into context. And then there'll be a chance for you to ask questions as well and for any of the panel. I'd like to start with Mark, with perhaps a very obvious question, Mark. Why choose this topic? What attracted you to this, the Colombian peace process in the first place, as a subject for a documentary film?
I was actually invited by some Colombian producers who had seen my previous films. And the reason they asked me as opposed to a Colombian was just very simply that I didn't know anything about Colombia. And they figured there were enough Colombians making films about this subject. Understandably, everyone in Colombia has personal and very like fixed views about the peace process. And they really wanted someone who was just starting from scratch. Which I guess, like, ultimately, like, every film that you make, you're kind of ultimately starting from scratch. But this was sort of particularly complex and difficult. And there were, like, multiple layers of things that we had to get across to an audience. So, and very fine lines between how much do you need to know to sort of care about things as the film's unfolding. And also, you know, really you want to be focusing on a few characters that kind of help you journey through that story. And, of course, getting access to presidents and leaders of guerrilla and Uribe on the other side, let alone, you know, the story of many hundreds of thousands or millions of victims. So the kind of the complex and the story that was unfolding as we were shooting and editing, and a presumption, wrongly, that the result would be yes. So that at a certain point in the edit, the sort of energy of the first two acts we had been cutting, presuming that the result would be yes for a nice happy ending, So we kind of had to backtrack through the film once the result was no. So yeah, it was,
even more complex process than you.
Yeah, I'm not sure I felt any less naive by the end of it.
There are so many. I think what your film highlighted for me, anyway, was that how many different components, small and large, that go into a peace process. I mean, we saw extraordinary footage of the demining, you know, the army working together with the guerrillas. We obviously saw the peace talks, the high level. You saw, you know, the faces of guerrillas, the faces of people really opposed to the agreement. So many different pieces in a mosaic. For you, what were the moments that stood out? What struck you or surprised you, perhaps?
Visually, there are a couple of moments. The point where the DVD skipped, which was the kid on the horse going through the demining area just on his way to school. And I really enjoyed shooting the part where Santos is giving a speech to the nation, and the speech maker, the speech writer, is sort of in the background, giving it all his passion. You know, and that, like, moments like that where you're, again, like a complete outsider, but you have access to power, really, and the sort of machine and system that surrounds power. So I was, the more I got into the film, the more I was interested in sort of visually uncovering those layers or exposing those layers. That ultimately, like, what you as a public receive in a very mediated way through politics and mainstream media, you know, is never, ever, ever the full picture, can never be the full picture. And then I think on, like, watching it now, you know, having finished it over a year and a half ago, I think it's very interesting to watch now because, for me, the story goes, I think, of course, it's a film about Colombia, but really it kind of sits in between. Brexit had happened first, and then this happened, and then Trump got into power. And I think it says something about, you know, this sort of new populist movement and sort of our responsibilities, like as audiences and filmmakers and anyone who's interested in, like, peace generally. And just how to sort of live together in any sense of harmony. I think now I watch the film and it speaks to those issues, you know, as much as it does about the sort of micro things that you mentioned that specific to Colombia.
And very interesting that the Colombians themselves were aware of the sort of the wider context and implications of it, as well as being obviously, understandably, a very introspective kind of process.
Yeah, and Santos was... you know, supremely aware of that on the one hand, and then Uribe is supremely aware of that on the other hand. And there was a moment that we didn't include, but there was when the results came in and we were filming in Santos's, in the presidential palace, and you could hear just someone go, "Oh God, is Colombia's Brexit?" So we thought, yeah, didn't need to put that in.
Annick, can I ask you, as coming from the UN side, because clearly the UN role in supporting and continuing to support this peace process, which, like most peace process, clearly is not linear, it's not straightforward. We've seen, you know, the first big bump in the road with the referendum, but it continues to be, and particularly now after the Colombian elections, very problematic. So what's the role, do you think, of outsiders, particularly an organization like the UN, in supporting it, making it, keeping it on the road, while obviously staying neutral?
Thank you very much. It's really an honor to be on this panel, and my esteemed Colombian colleague already thanked the United Nations, but we want to thank actually Colombia, because of course it is really a pleasure to be able to talk about a success also for the United Nations, and it's not every day that we have parties to a conflict referring themselves to the Security Council and asking for support from the international community. So thank you very much, and also to London School of Economics. I should say that the United Kingdom also plays a unique role within the context of the Security Council as the pen holder for the resolutions for Colombia. So indeed, I think it was we already had a very good indication of well, first from the movie, the difficulties around the peace agreement and how difficult it is to reach a peace agreement. But then actually, you know, the fact that the hard work actually starts once the peace agreement is signed. And we have to commend the Colombian authorities and the people of Colombia for this, the cycle of elections that happened this year in 2018, as was mentioned. This we cannot underestimate this achievement, because it was peaceful, inclusive, historically inclusive. People were able to vote without restrictions. Offices did not have to be closed, and this was not necessarily to be taken for granted. So this was a huge achievement. Before that, of course, the UN was very involved through its first mission, the UN mission in Colombia on the disarmament process for the FARC. So we've had now two missions that operate, of course, besides a large United Nations country team, almost 2,000 staff, I think, which are not part of these missions. So this is really the missions that are mandated by the Security Council. So the first mission was really focused on the disarmament of the FARC. And there were some statistics already mentioned, but I can name some more. So 9,000 arms that were counted in the laying down process, 3,500 anti-personnel mines that were destroyed, 20,000 grenades. So a huge amount of work there for the United Nations mission to make sure that those arms could not be used to kill people, but instead be turned into statues to commemorate peace. And then now we've moved into the September 2017, that process was wrapped up, the first mandate. Then 2017, we moved on to the second mission, the verification mission in Colombia. And here we're really looking at building irreversible peace. And that's something that the entire spectrum of the political parties in Colombia are committed to. There's no question to that. And looking at how the government is also doing some of the aspects of the peace agreement that were agreed, such as the reintegration of the FARC into civilian life, essentially, and also security, personal and collective security guarantees, which is also extremely important. Of course, there are some challenges that are still ongoing. I mean, It's a process, of course, to implement a complicated peace agreement, so we still have to link up some of the short-term achievements also on reinsertion in terms of the stipends that are being paid out and linking them to a longer-term integration plan, a national integration plan. There's also elements of improving the state's presence across Colombia, so that this is all things that still need to be worked on and improved. There's, of course, also a separate process with the ELN. There's been five rounds of negotiations on that. There's a lot of commitment to try to make that work. The UN would also want to make sure that those ceasefire protocols are firm, and the UN might also be asked to monitor that process in the future. So United Nations is committed, of course, the Security Council fully, also fully following this. The 26th of July is when the next Security Council consultations take place. This will be after the FARC, after the new legislature comes into, takes its seat, so it will be an interesting month under the Swedish presidency.
And how do you address the situation now where there is a new administration which is committed to reviewing or revising the peace agreement? You have, at country level, you have a lot of programs in place, as you say, to deal with the multi-level aspects of any peace process. Can they continue despite the change in politics at Bogota level?
Well, the Secretary General was already very heartened by the one of the first statements that Ivan Duque made, which is that he wants to heal the divisions in Colombian society. So we are actually quite hopeful that the process will continue. There may be some modifications to it in terms of exactly how land reform is achieved. There might be a different vision for the president-elect than for President Santos, for example. But we do feel that the entire spectrum of Colombian society, and it was mentioned in the film, no one wants to vote, or I think they said they don't want to vote against peace, something like that. So, of course, there are elements in the society that would maybe want to see transitional justice have happened before the 20th of July. So this is part of a normal implementation of a peace agreement, I would say. Mm.
Thank you. Can I turn to John Lord Alderdice? We've had the 20th compared to a rather new peace process in Colombia. We've this year had the 20th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement and the Northern Ireland peace process. What did you take from the film and from what you know has been happening in Colombia and relate it to your own experiences? How do the two, are they comparable? We know that local context always matters a very great deal, but are there similarities that you can detect and you might have seen tonight between the two processes?
Film is a very powerful medium, and I think that what has struck me particularly over the last few years is how important it is to connect in with the emotional dimension of people, not just as individuals, but as a whole community. Mm-hmm. And actually the arts, drama, music, poetry, film are extremely important in this, because they can get to places that a more didactic, cerebral approach can't reach. And if you read through all the manuals of how to do peace processes, you'll find lots and lots of protocols of things that you need to do. Things that we did in Northern Ireland, as you've said, constitutional change, institutional change, policing, administration of justice, socioeconomic development, community development. And you can do all of those things as we did and still find that underneath the attitudes haven't changed. And that's one of the things that came across very powerfully in the film. And it was very moving to see a lot of the people and the places, whether it was up in the jungle or the presidential palace or whatever, that I know quite well over the last few years. And the thing that's constant, whether it's Israel-Palestine or Northern Ireland or Colombia, is that you're dealing with people, groups of people who have historic disturbed relationships going back a long way. You don't come to a terrorist campaign that goes on like this just overnight. And Mark could have, he picked up at 64, but he could have gone back to 46 or much further back to point out the depth of these historic disturbed relationships. And that's what came through to me in my own work at home, because a lot of political science traditionally in the past said that people do these kinds of things because it's in their best interests. And what was manifestly clear to me at home was that people were not doing things in their best interests at all. Their own community was being more damaged and destroyed than the people they were fighting against. And I found exactly the same thing everywhere else that I've gone, whether it's Peru or Nepal or the Balkans or Southeast Asia or Colombia or other parts of Latin America or at home. What happens is people get engaged as communities in doing things that are manifestly not in their own best interest. You can see that from people like Dymachenko and his colleagues there. They don't look back and say, yay. They look back and they think, what about all the people that died? What about the families we don't know anymore? We go back, they won't want us, and so on. It's a very disturbing, painful business. And that's one of the reasons I went into psychiatry and psychoanalysis, was because I thought, who is going to help me understand why people do self-destructive things? And what I discovered, of course, was that whatever, and you're quite right, whatever the different historic issues that are particular to a context, what is consistent and constant is you're dealing with human beings, groups of people. Almost inevitably, you have at least one group of people that feels humiliated and disrespected, that feel deeply unfairly treated, that has found it impossible to use peaceful democratic means to make a change in those kinds of things. And they end up falling back into this violence. Not because strategically it's a smart move. You don't look at a film like this and say, well, you know, if I'm unhappy about things, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to do what Fark did. You don't come away with that feeling. And I think that's a very powerful and accurate representation. But people sometimes do things because they get so angry, frustrated, hurt, damaged, that as a whole community, they explode into this. And of course, you can have a conversation like this, but once somebody hits somebody and somebody hits them back, a whole new dynamic of violence gets created that can go on for generations. And so trying to capture that and convey it and give something of the positive but extremely difficult side, but at the same time says there's, in a very powerful way, this is a disturbed and disturbing way of being in community. And whether we look at it in Colombia or whether we take Colombia as an example, an exemplar of what is happening globally, I think that's where the film becomes extremely powerful for me. And of course, we know that things have happened since, and they're quite mixed. And even as we sit here, we're not certain what the next little while will bring. Duque has been elected, but when somebody's elected as a leader, that's a very different place from being a commentator or in the opposition. And sometimes people who are very good in opposition aren't great as leaders, or on the other hand, people who say one thing in opposition become different. In Northern Ireland, Ian Paisley, who was the arch enemy of the peace process, the one who insisted on walking out as soon as Sinn Féin walked in the end, ended in a coalition government with Martin McGuinness, one of the most leading terrorist organisers in the world. And they ended up working together so much that they got called the Chuckle Brothers, because they even enjoyed each other's jokes. You can't predict the future, but you can try to commit yourself in understanding the human condition to make a better future. And one of the really positive things about this film is it shows it warts and all. It doesn't portray peace building as something that's going to have a load of people signing up forms for the UN, because the reality is very tough and painful and difficult. And I think it's an extremely powerful representation of that. Thank you, Martin.
Absolutely, yeah. Thank you. Thank you all. I'd like to open it up now. I'm sure there are lots of questions or comments. So I think there are some roving mics. If anybody would like to start us up, please raise your hand and tell us who you are. I've got some at the very back, I can see. Is there a mic? All right, you go as you've got the mic in your hand, in the pink shirt.
My name is Viviana Sarmiento. I am Colombian. I study here at the LSE, a master's degree. And actually, the topic of my dissertation is the campaign of the referendum. And I wanted to ask Lord Alvarez, regarding you participated, you were involved on the Good Friday Agreement. And I wanted to ask you if you think that the FARC could have played a more active role in the campaigning as it happened in Northern Ireland, and if that could have had any effect on the end result of the referendum campaign.
I was very nervous about the idea of having a referendum. There were a number of reasons for that. In Northern Ireland, in Ireland, when we reached an agreement, it was a slim document. We were able to produce copies and send them to every single household in the country and say, this is what's been agreed, read it. And families could sit down and read it and argue about it over the table. And if somebody said, you know, the agreement says this, you could leaf it over and say, it doesn't. Look at page 24, it doesn't say that at all. What was agreed in Havana was this huge document. So if somebody who didn't like the peace process was to say, well, you know, it says this, it's almost impossible for anybody, even a journalist, to go through all the detailed documentation that was there. And some of that detail came because FARC wanted to try to get everything tied up and sorted out. And it's very understandable, but I think it was a strategic mistake. It's also the case that with us, Sinn Féin and the rest of us were negotiating close to home. What did that mean? It meant every night when you went home, you were talking and arguing and debating with all your own people around the countryside and bringing them along with you and explaining why you did this and why you agreed that and why you agreed the other thing. One of the problems about having it in Havana, and I absolutely understand why that was the case, but one of the problems was that FARC people and indeed people on the government side were not so easily able to go out and engage with people in the community and bring them along with you. Because if you don't bring the people along with you, no matter what you've agreed, and by the way, it's not a question of bringing your enemy to the point where he or she agrees something that they can't deliver. There's no point in that. So I think there were, and there were lots of other things that one could speak about which were differences. There were some things in this agreement which were much better than what we did. They started having a victim's law. We left the issue of dealing with the victims right away to the end whenever people don't care too much because, well, it's all over, you know. So I think there were some things where they might have done it differently to advantage, and there were some things which are an example to other places. But one of the things is very clear, and it's very clear in the Colombian referendum, and it's clear in the Brexit referendum, and it's clear in all sorts of... There's an unpredictability now about politics, much more than there was 10 years ago, and there's a different atmosphere. When we were doing the business, political leaders around the world saw themselves as statesmen, whether it was Gorbachev or Clinton or Mitchell or Mandela or de Klerk. They saw themselves as statesmen and women when they resolve conflict. Now, people see themselves as great leaders when they conduct conflicts. It's a very different atmosphere, and it's much more difficult to deliver. And I think we have to recognize that what President Santos and people in FARC were doing was doing it against a background that was much more problematic in terms of global feeling and zeitgeist than was the case for us 20 years ago.
Yeah, it's an interesting distinction. I've got two at the back. Three. We'll take three from the back. Maybe all together, if that's all right with you.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm also from Colombia. I'm studying social policy, but I want to ask to Mark Silver as journalist. I appreciate to have this evidence, but I want to know how we can construct social evidence when we ignore the main population of Colombia, which are children. So my question to you is, which have been your main reasons to not to approach the reality of children inside the conflict, inside the FARC, and also how, as advocates for children, should we work to guarantee the representation when we do this evidence about our conflict? Thank you.
Hi there. My name is Omar. I'm a PhD candidate here at the Department of Government. My question is to the director, do you think your representation of the FARC is impartial? I want to state it this way. Because the perception that most Colombians have, of course, is of the FARC as they know campaign, they prostrate almost paradoxically, but to the extreme. But then many Colombians see them as drug smugglers, as people who bring child soldiers to fight. So do you think that the movie actually represents that? Because there is a part in which they say, oh, and actually there was drug smuggling in the whole of the country, and then the FARC were inevitably in it. But was it inevitable? Are the FARC actually 100% political as the movie sort of represents? Because there is a big part of the FARC, and I think that's what the Colombians think, that it's not political at all. Thank you. By the way, I voted yes in the referendum. No, just.
Yeah, sorry. Just do the tackle the drugs thing if you can.
People did yes in the referendum.
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't. take one more. I had one more right at the back.
Yeah. So my name is Yelena, and I'm a political science graduate from Sciences Po Paris. And I had a question probably to the representative of Juan Lopes. Since the movie, I think, touched a really one of the particular parts of it was justice and the question of it and in light of what happened. My question is about the truth in the Truth Commission that's been established and just recently started to work, I think, in May. Do you think people will accept it in light of them being so mad at what has been done by both sides and particularly FARC as well? Is there anything that's underway to make sure that it's accepted? As you know, we've seen in the past that, especially in recent example with Kosovo, sometimes people don't find legitimacy in international tribunals and such organizations, and they might have different understandings of what justice is. So thank you.
Thank you. I'll start with Mark. Two questions, really, on children and possibly how you portray the FARC. Are they drug runners and political ideologues?
Yes. No. So on the kids thing, we couldn't get access to children within the FARC from either the FARC or the government, who at that time were running a program where they were bringing kids out of the FARC and trying to find and meet again with their families. And it was such a sensitive issue that it was just a closed door to us. And because of the nature of the film, the way that we made the film, that we weren't kind of... We were trying to limit the amount of talking head-type interviews and referencing to many of the complex issues of the past. We just had to sort of park that because it just didn't fit into the way that we were trying to construct the film. And, of course, that is, you know, a massive thing that is lacking in the film. But we also, I guess, saw things like the demining scene and the digging up of remains as, I guess, metaphorical for a huge amount of undiscussed and uncovered things. I mean, literally, it felt like the land, the soil, you know, contained many hundreds of thousands of stories that obviously we're not going to be able to cover in one film. On the who are the FARC, basically. So again, you could make 100 different films about who the FARC are and probably get, you know, 100 different opinions. So again, we tried to just ride a very fine line between what is generally considered the FARC sort of relationship with cocaine, both from them, that they say, you know, we're not here because, like, our main aim is not to be selling cocaine, but anything that happens in our territory, we will take advantage of and fund. At that time, they would have said resistance to things like Plan Colombia. But even if I just say that sentence, we could probably spend all night deconstructing that about what part of what word is true and not true. So we kind of took a line that, yeah, of course, as an audience, you need to have a relationship with that history. But the film, you know, is very much set in the present. And whilst you need to understand the past to understand the present, you know, we didn't feel like really getting heavily into that was going to help an audience's understanding of the present and the peace process and how it was or wasn't going to unfold. So that was like some of the thinking that went into that. I know that doesn't answer like the, you know, the depth of your question, but I just can't, you know, in this context, it would take hours.
Annick, truth commissions, they can be a bit of a go-to for the international community.
Yeah.
How in Colombia can you
Yes, thank assist? You very much. It's a very, very good question because I think it comes to the heart of what was one of the more difficult issues in Havana, of course. And it also, comes to the point of the implementation of what's written down on a paper on black and white, and actually how does that work in practice? So when you have a transitional justice mechanism, for example, in the case of Colombia, you would want to make sure that any of the any outcome of that doesn't impede political participation of the party that's going through that process, for example. On the other hand, for the FARC, they will also have to be truthful and come forward with the information that they have, and that's part of the difficulty in the implementation, and that's still to be seen.
Right, I'm going to take another round. I've got some down here. Two in the middle. And one over here. Okay, you begin then.
I'm a student at Sixth Form, and I was just wondering that something that this film portrayed was the fact that many people were very much opposed to the referendum, and how do you think the fact that the deal was still signed into law despite the result has impacted that demographic?
Thank you. I've got two, Joe down here, two in the middle block, gentlemen in the...
Yes, this question is really directed to you, Lord Alderdice. I'm a little confused with the outcome of this film because there didn't seem to be much mention of acceptance of the crimes committed over all those years of civil war. And I'm fearful that whatever peace has been negotiated now, in my view, as a non-student of Latin American politics, I may add, could be very fragile. Because this 50% of the country has not had any sort of justice for the terrors and the wars that were committed over that period. And the film didn't seem to make much account of that. And I don't know how far the political process in Colombia now is in recognition of those crimes. I'd welcome your input on that, please.
Did you want to take any more questions?
Or? Yeah, sorry. One more. Yeah, you've got the microphone.
Thank you very much. My question is addressed to Lord Alderdice and Ms. Hinch. I was wondering, in the terms of these kind of agreements and peace deals, do you ever worry about, in a case, it might be like the better the devil you know, in the sense that the ELN is still active, narco trafficking in Colombia still continues massively through like Buenaventura, and social security still not as it is, and in the case of Northern Ireland as well, you know, obviously with Brexit divisions, there's still the threat of Republican violence, inter-community violence. Did you ever find that once the main organisation has been removed, smaller and potentially more violent actors step into the space where they once held some sort of stability?
Okay, one more down here, last one, and then I'll let the panellists respond. Yeah.
Thank you very much for the film. I thought it was really a very interesting film. And I think that you made the point that you couldn't cover all perspectives in one film. And I actually think that by following the two negotiators at that time really made it quite an impact. But I'm very aware that the civil society took a massive role in this peace, the peace talks. And a very interesting one, too, because I think it was the civil society, the victims going to Havana, that actually made the FARC realize that they couldn't have complete amnesty for the crimes that they'd committed. And I'm not sure that they really understood that reality until then. And also, I think women in particular played a massive role. And the gender focus throughout the peace accord has been something that's really important, and important now for peace, I think, in terms of women and equality, and also the levels of violence that they've suffered, both generalized and sexual violence. So I was just thinking that it'd be quite interesting to see a filmmaker make a film about the role of civil society in these talks. And also because I think Colombia faces a rough ride ahead, just right at this minute in time, in terms of the implementation of the peace accord. It's not going to be straightforward by any means. and trying to really reinforce what civil society said yes to and actually put into that peace deal could also be a very positive way of contributing to the continued discussion about how you implement the peace process. So I haven't really got a question, but I wanted to make that comment.
Thank you. All right. Can I, John, start with you? Take a couple of issues there, I think, on the accountability issue and the kind of impunity as a feature, and also the vacuum that's created when you have this kind of shift in dynamics with the peace agreement. What's your view on those?
One of the things Mark said was this is a very complex situation and there's a lot to it that you can't convey in a film, and that's absolutely true. The first thing to understand is all sides were involved in absolutely colossal atrocities. It's been quite clear, for example, for a long time, but evidenced by recent taped phone calls, that President Uribe, who you saw there, actually set up for paramilitary organizations to go out and kill people, and not just operators or activists, but people in civil society too. It's quite clear the paramilitaries were established, set up, run, paid by very respectable elements of establishment. It's clear that the question of cocaine was not something that FARC started with. But it may come to your attention that you can't go to the bank and ask for a mortgage to run a terrorist campaign. So if anybody's going to run a terrorist campaign, you're going to have to commit crime to do it, to get the resources to do it. That's why the IRA robbed banks and all sorts of things. I remember the first time I met somebody from the IRA who was talking about that. He says, there's an awful lot of stuff about us robbing banks. It's the banks that's robbing the ordinary people. The truth, it depends where you see it from, but the truth is, these problems go back long before FARC. When people stood up from a liberal perspective, for example, previously, they were assassinated. So you're absolutely right to point up that there's a fragility about all of this, because you do not get the sense that people right across the community, on all sides, are looking back and saying, I need to understand why you did this in order that none of us need to go back to it. You're still at a place where people are blaming the other side, and the guns may be silent. And I have to tell you, I'm absolutely astonished at how quickly the guns were dealt with. I was through the whole process of dealing with the weapons in Northern Ireland. I tell you, the IRA were an awful lot harder to get the weapons off than FARC. Which says to me something about the commitment of FARC to bring this to a close. They were tired of it. Now, the problem is that when FARC have come out of those areas and gone to the centres where they were brought together, the state was not able to move in sufficiently quickly to take control of those areas for a whole bunch of reasons. I'm not blaming anybody, I'm saying that's the fact. And what has happened is a combination of dissident FARC, ELN, drug cartels, people coming across from all sorts of people have gone in and taken control. And the danger is that that situation can become worse with no clear political agenda necessarily. So you're dealing with a very difficult, complex area, and you're absolutely right to point out that we're moving into a period of difficulty and risk. No question about that. And I just desperately hope that people are able to hold things together, that President Duque, when he comes in, recognizes that it's a very different world being in the presidential palace looking out than being outside looking in, and that he will try and get some support for holding things together, because apart from Colombia itself, this is really one of the very few serious peace processes anywhere in the world that's going anywhere at all. And if you can find a way of rubbishing that peace process, what's the morale message that goes out to people all around the world desperately trying, through the UN or separately, to create peace? Colombia knows, and I'm talking to a lot of people on all sides, they know, as a lot of people in my part of the world know, that you're not just carrying a responsibility for hope for your own country, but also hope for other countries as well. And that's why we need to really get behind those who are trying to make this work. And it's a real challenge. You're absolutely right to point out the problem. The problem about accountability is this. You've got to decide for yourself, what's the more important thing, being right or having peace? Because you can go on endlessly trying to get, quote, justice and condemn the next generation to more misery. And one of the problems, for example, with the International Criminal Court is that you could not get a Good Friday Agreement now with the ICC, because the sorts of things we did in order to get the IRA on side, you couldn't actually deliver now because of things like the ICC. So you've got to be really careful that the law does not stand in the way of relationships rather than facilitating and protecting them. Yeah. Big questions you've asked.
Thank you. We're going to have to wrap up. Can I ask? Final word from Annick and Mark, maybe to the point about civil society, but perhaps particularly the gender aspect as to the role of women in this and other peace processes from your perspective, and maybe what you, your impression from making the film. We saw a few, in fact, quite prominently, didn't we, women guerrillas, but not so many on the other side. So a word on maybe gender and civil society.
Very quickly, also on the, because I think there was also a question on the devil you know. So just very quickly, I think the ELN, with the ELN, it was actually, I mean, they've agreed a ceasefire during the elections. So I think there's been a very positive story there, just very briefly. I mean, there have been problems with the implementation of crop substitute cocoa substitution that hasn't gone fast enough, and UNODC is doing a lot of work negotiating with farmers to get those substitution programs up and running. But for the case of Colombia, I'm not sure if that's been the case. In terms of gender, yes, in the peace agreement process, there was definitely very, very good participation of women's groups. That hasn't necessarily translated to the implementation of the particularly reintegration programs. So we need to do a lot more work to make sure that there's better analysis on how to reintegrate women more effectively. That's definitely an area of work for the UN. The mission itself has 41 gender focal points across the country and is actively involved in this.
You know, just to say, yeah, of course, I agree that there can and should be many other films made about what is happening, particularly with civil society. And again, there was a very moving moment where the victims went from Colombia to Havana, and as you said, like, presented their stories to the FARC. Filmically, we just couldn't be in another scene of a conference room with people talking, because there are many, and there's already too many. And we took the two other scenes, so again, like the digging up of the remains as a metaphor for many victims. And also what I think the FARC went through that day in Havana, they also went through in Boyajá, where the church that was bombed, where they then went back to apologize. And it's just as, you know, it's just one of the difficulties of filmmaking, that do we choose that scene because of the sort of editorial reasons that we have this footage and this narrative and this character and this emotion, or do we choose the other scene? And so it really just came down to that in the edit. And that scene was just more intimate than what we could have shown happened in Havana in a conference room. That was the only reason.
Thank you. We've way run over, and apologies for detaining everybody, but I think on your behalf, I'd like to thank all of our panel.